This is Macro Voices with hedge fund manager Eric Townsend, the free weekly financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Macro Voices is all about the brightest minds in the world of finance and macroeconomics telling it like it is, bullish or bearish, no holds barred. Now, here are your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Serezna.
Macro Voices episode 155 was recorded on February 21st, 2019. I'm Eric Townsend. Forest for the Trees founder Luke Groman joins me as this week's feature interview guest. Now, Luke's critics have said that his views about the U.S. dollar might be spot on, but it's at least an eight-year story that couldn't possibly play out in the time frame that Luke has predicted. Luke, on the other hand, says that they're exactly right, that it is an eight-year story. He just thinks they missed the fact that it started playing out 6 years ago and only has a couple of years left before his dire predictions, in which the U.S. government faces a funding crisis and is forced to monetize debt service payments, is going to start coming true. But wait, there's more. One of Luke's most outspoken critics has been our friend Brent Johnson from Santiago Capital. Brent will join us in our post-game segment to discuss Luke's interview and to offer the counter-argument, explaining why Brent believes that Luke is early in his predictions.
And I'm Patrick Serezna. Now, Eric, let's jump to that S&P 500, because today we were 2 points away from 2,800, and then suddenly we began a market correction. At the time of recording, we're trading at 2,767 on the S&P 500. We've been waiting for some form of a market pullback to begin. Is this the start of it?
Well, Patrick, we hit that trend line I've been watching, and I bought put spreads, 2750 to 2500 on the June expiry, paid $45 for those last night on that spike up, and I'll convert those to outright shorts on a move below 2650. Is it on? Possibly. We'll see what happens. But throwing out any preconceptions and just taking a fresh look at this chart, you know, we're already past the 61.8 and 70.7 Fibonacci levels. Normally, when you go past those, you're going all the way to 100. The next Fibonacci level is 78.6%. That would come at 2812. You know, if it doesn't stop there, it's hard to make a case for why we wouldn't move to new all-time highs. I suppose you could try to say that the pre-VIX blow-up high, which was around 2877 or so, might have been a left shoulder, and then we had a top, and maybe we're forming a right shoulder. Frankly, the bottom of that pattern doesn't look like a head and shoulders pattern, so I don't think that's really a valid argument. But at the level that we're at, I think we need in future shows to start talking, especially if this continues to move higher, about the possibility of either double tops, fresh highs, and what these signals could mean. Certainly, if we're going to have a market correction that plays out the way I have anticipated that it would, it maybe is a little bit early in terms of timing, but it's late in terms of price level. We're already at such high levels. So we'll see what happens. This afternoon looks like maybe the start of something, but frankly, that trend line was really obvious on the chart. I sold it. A lot of other people sold it. It's no surprise that we're seeing a pullback. Are we going to end up with a little pullback that lasts for a day or two and then just push higher? Or is this next top finally in? I will let you know next week.
All right, well, let's move on to that U.S. dollar index, because last week we were messing around above the 97 handle. And here we finally got about a 3-4 day pullback in the dollar, heading down toward 96, but no real heavy selling. I mean, what's your thinking? Is the dollar uptrend still intact?
Oh, I absolutely think that it is. We tested a new contract high last Friday, and you know, then we pulled back about one full point. Big deal. Perfectly normal, healthy bull market pullback. Look at the number of up days in a row. We were overdue for a pullback. We got less than one big handle, and it looks like we're set to close above 96.50 today. We're speaking a little bit before the close, so it's early to say. But it looks to me like we're seeing a small pullback and a very healthy bull market rally trend. So I'm still bullish on the dollar, and I think the arguments, even Luke Groman, who's got to be the world's most most outspoken long-term dollar bear is tactically bullish the dollar in this environment. We'll hear more about that from Luke in today's feature interview. So I'm absolutely bullish on the dollar. I don't think it has the meaning of good for the U.S. economy. I think it's a liquidity squeeze, as Jeff Snyder has described so eloquently on this program. But I think we're moving higher.
All right, well, let's move on to crude oil, because throughout the week, we've seen a breakout to a new one-month high. How high does crude oil go here?
Well, I was stopped out of my short from 55 spot 25 on the March contract. As I said on last week's show, the tell there was RBOB gasoline. It's really amazing how accurately RBOB will sometimes predict what WTI is going to do next. We had that signal on Thursday, and sure enough, I was stopped out on Friday. I did re-enter my short trade, though, yesterday when we touched the 100-day moving average. That was 57 spot 48 that I shorted on the April contract, and we'll see what happens. As far as inventory this week, crude oil building 1.3 million barrels. Cushing, Oklahoma, holy cow, building 3.2 million barrels. That's a really, really big one-week build. But remember, last week, we had that depressed number. It was a drawdown, and that was because the pipeline had to be shut down due to a spill in St. Louis. I think maybe what we're seeing with the really big number is they're making up by pumping a little bit more to cover that outage period on the pipeline. I don't think this is the beginning of a new trend where we're going to see 3 million barrels every week building in Cushing. Gasoline drawing down 1.6 million barrels. Distillates drawing down 758,000 barrels. U.S. production moving up to a new all-time record, 12 million barrels, higher than Saudi Arabia. The U.S. is the biggest oil producer in the world. Also, record exports this week, new all-time record of 25.2 million barrels exported on the week. I'm converting the 3.6 million barrel daily number to a weekly number in order to have it match up to the rest of the numbers that we're talking about, which are weekly figures. So if we look at the fundamentals here, the hard data is darned clear here. It's showing us that the market is already oversupplied, and it's getting more oversupplied as evidenced by U.S. production data hitting new all-time high U.S. production. The propaganda side of this market, on the other hand, is Saudi Arabia is masterfully jawboning the market higher with talk of bigger and bigger cuts. Look, if you look at the data and the inventory numbers and the fact that Russia has refused to match Saudi Arabia's cuts, it's very clear to me, Patrick, that the hard data should be winning out, but so far it's the propaganda that's been driving the market higher. I do think that we should head back down toward 45, maybe even 40 if the economy gets really ugly. But there is a caveat. Remember last week, RBOB was the tell. Well, this week, as we're speaking on Thursday afternoon, RBOB closed above its 100-day moving average. WTI moved up, kissed that 100-day moving average. I sold it short, and it's come off nicely. RBOB has climbed through its 100-day moving average, and both WTI and RBOB are above their 5, 8, and 13-day moving averages. When they're above all three of those are uptrend conditions. So we do have another potential tell of RBOB suggesting that maybe I'll be stopped out again and we'll move higher. But frankly, I'll re-enter that short again. I really don't think we're going higher than 60, and I do think that hard data will win out over propaganda eventually. There has been really strong support at 51, so even though I think we're eventually headed back toward 45, I may cover my short if we hit 51 just tactically, but I think we're eventually headed back down to 45.
All right, well, let's move on to gold, because gold just ripped. I mean, we hit pretty much 1350 on the upside, but after the FOMC, it seems to be taking a bit of a break. We're about $20 off the highs at the time of recording. What's your thinking here on gold?
Well, one of those frustrating trading stories, Patrick. I missed that entry by a dollar. I had a resting limit order at 1301. I thought we were going to retest the round number at 1300 before moving higher, and I missed it, and it was a great move. The thing is, 1350 has been the resistance level that's been holding for like 5 years now. It's a really big, important level. So the sharp sell-off of the last 2 days might have been brought about by FOMC minutes, but frankly, I would expect it anyway. Anytime you get to a major resistance level, which has held at least 4 times in the last 5 years, some technical traders are going to be selling that because they're convinced that that resistance is going to sell again. So the idea that we're seeing a pullback from that key resistance level because some people are selling it should surprise nobody. The question is, what happens next? Do we continue selling off? Certainly, if we go below 1304, which was the contract low on the April contract, okay, that's a new message. On the other hand, if we go above 1350, close over 1350, and stay there for a few days, that's a really major important breakout, and that would be extremely bullish. We haven't seen it yet. Let's wait and see what happens. I very much regret having missed that entry at 1302 instead of 1301 where my limit order was resting, but I'm not going to chase it here. I'm going to wait and see what happens. A break above 1350, I would certainly buy that on momentum.
Well, let's finally touch on that 10-year treasury yield, because the yields have been generally downward sloping. I mean, we were testing below 265 on a number of occasions throughout February. It seems after the FOMC that we've gotten a little bit of a reaction higher. We're almost up to the 270 level on the upside. What's your thinking here on which direction interest rates are going here?
Yeah, I'm looking at 269 on my chart as we're speaking late Thursday afternoon, a little bit before the close. You know, we're steadying in the middle of that range between 2 spot 60 and 2 spot 80. And I think we need a signal outside of that range in order to really give us a directional indication. Generally, though, I think recessions always bring lower yields. If we are headed into a recession, which a lot of people think we are, we should start seeing lower treasury yields. I'm not really looking at trading this move right now. I don't have a lot of conviction about it. What I really think about is the Big Short. If we go below 2%, or even if we get a retest of that 1 spot 34, which so far has been the low yield on the 10-year, I think that eventually the Julian Brigden view is going to play out and that we're eventually headed much, much higher in yield. But if we're headed into an economic downturn and recession, yields are going to go lower before they go higher. I think even Julian has agreed with us on that point on this program. So it's a question of when does that short trade set up? It's definitely not yet. Do you want to be long bonds right now? A lot of people are saying yes. I'm going to pass on it. I don't have strong enough conviction.
All right. Well, this week's featured interview guest is Luke Grohman. Now, Eric, let's review why we invited Luke back on as this week's featured guest and why we're bringing Brent Johnson in the post game to follow up.
Well, Patrick, Luke Grohman was dismissed as a lunatic 5 or 6 years ago when he started writing about some fairly dire predictions for the U.S. dollar. And then a whole bunch of his predictions started coming true, and people have been taking him more and more seriously. One of the most interesting moments at our Macro Voices live event in Vancouver, I felt, was when Brent Johnson introduced the topic. I allowed the panelists, hey, let's talk about the most important topics in finance. What is it? Is it treasury yields? Is it inflation? What is it? And Brent said, is Luke Grohman crazy? That's the question that we have to ask. And he did it in a very respectful and professional way. But Brent disagrees with Luke with respect to the timing. And when I heard him say that, I asked the entire panel of people, and we had some incredibly, incredibly brilliant people, from Julian Brigden to Juliet DeClercq to Jeff Snyder there. Unanimously, Patrick, they all agreed that Luke's dire predictions about the U.S. dollar will be proven correct in the end. 100% unanimous agreement that Luke will be proven right in the end. A lot of people thought that Luke is way early in his predictions. They think it's going to take longer to play out than Luke is predicting. And I was really struck in that moment on stage. And it was in that moment I said to myself, we got to get Luke back on the program for an update. So that's what brought this about. And I really encourage you, when you're listening to some of Luke's predictions as to where things are ultimately headed, we had a really, really smart panel of people at Macro Voices Live in Vancouver. And although there was considerable disagreement about the timing of Luke's predictions, they all agreed that what he's predicting is going to happen eventually. Some of them just thought it would take longer than Luke thinks it's going to take. And these are some pretty serious predictions. So I think you're going to really enjoy this interview, and then we'll bring Brent Johnson in for the counterpoint perspective in the postgame segment following the feature interview. So whatever you do, stay tuned for the postgame segment.
Yeah, I have to say, I did really enjoy that panel discussion, and it was just a great event. Anyway, Eric's interview with Luke Roman is coming up as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com.
And now with this week's special guest, here's hedge fund manager Eric Townsend.
Joining me next on the program is Forest for the Trees founder and chief investment officer Luke Groman. Luke prepared a slide deck for today's conversation. I strongly encourage everyone to download it. You'll find the download link in your Research Roundup email, or if you're not yet registered, just look for the red button labeled Looking for the Downloads next to Luke's picture on our homepage at macrovoices.com. Luke, it's been too long. Thanks for coming back on the program. You've had some very, very outspoken views, and when you first started writing about this stuff years ago, everybody thought you were completely crazy. Now, what I'm hearing from a lot of people is maybe they think you're early, but they don't think you're crazy anymore. For people who aren't familiar with your views, why don't we just go ahead and dive into your slide deck? Tell us why you see the whole situation around the U.S. dollar, U.S. Treasury market, and so forth a little differently than the mainstream that you hear about on CNBC and Bloomberg.
Sure. Yeah. Thanks for having me on, Eric. It's great to be back again. I think we're have a different counterintuitive view than a lot of folks, which is to say, ironically, the dollar is rising due to foreign central bank refutation of treasuries. And that seems pretty counterintuitive as it stands for our positioning now. We're overweight cash in dollars, we're overweight gold, we're overweight treasuries. The biggest difference is driving our view and others' views is underlying motives and timing, right? So if you go to slide three, you can see as early as the second quarter of 2014, you began seeing Russia and China working to transact in trade, and in particular energy outside of the dollar. Go to slide four. This was the headline of a report that we wrote back in September of 2014, so almost 5 years ago now, asking, is the dollar so strong precisely because it has begun losing its 40-year-old monopoly on pricing the global oil trade? You go to slide five, and you can see a quote from a speech in October of 2014 from the former chief of staff of U.S. Secretary of State Colin Powell, noting that what you're seeing right now in the supposed strengthening of the dollar is really a false impression being driven by an attempt by Russia, China, and others to transact in energy outside of the dollar system. And you can see on slide six, you can see this start to manifest in the behavior of foreign holdings, of foreign central bank holdings in particular, of treasury bonds. You go to slide six and you can see China's holdings of U.S. treasuries peaked in late 13 and have been on a downward slope ever since. You can see Russia, of course, this year has been a year where they basically in the last 6 months have sold all their treasuries. But the blue line on slide seven is Russia's holdings of treasuries. The orange line that's going up and to the right at an ever steeper angle is their holdings of gold. And this makes sense because ultimately, if Russia and China are transacting in energy outside of the dollar-centric system, their need to hold reserves in dollars shrinks over time. A question we've often got as we go through this is, well, what will Russia do with renminbi or yuan as if they get paid in renminbi or yuan? And you can see on slide eight that as far back as 2009, China was advocating both more gold reserves for itself as well as leading the way for other nations to reserve more gold instead of dollars as a way of promoting the internationalization of the renminbi. And importantly, as you go to slide nine, you can see on slide nine there, you can see in 2010, central banks started following what China was saying. They began buying gold in the most amounts in decades, and actually last year bought the most gold since 1967. And so what this really all funnels back to can be seen on slide 10. And this to us, we highlighted on Twitter a week or two ago. This chart from the Wall Street Journal, we think is absolutely a critical moment, which you can see yellow line is foreign investors' holdings of treasuries. The green line is U.S. investors. And in 2014, foreign central banks, foreign investors in total, led by central banks, stopped buying treasury bonds on net. You can see it very clearly.
Okay, hold on a second, Luke, because I'm still trying to catch up with, you've got excellent data here showing that a lot of people are ditching the dollar and no longer using the dollar in trade, particularly for oil, and also, therefore, not needing to hold as much dollar reserves. How do we get from there to dollar appreciating? You said it was counterintuitive. I agree on that. Explain.
Absolutely. So that you can see, right? So you slide 10, we see this divergence. Central banks stop buying treasuries, and so foreign investors stop buying treasuries. And you go to slide 11, this is a chart of the real trade-weighted dollar. And you can see it clear as day. When they stopped buying treasury bonds, the dollar took off like a scalded cat. And the reason why it's taken off, why a cessation of foreign central bank and foreign investor buying of treasuries drove a higher dollar, can be seen on slide 12. Now, this chart is U.S. Treasury holdings by investor type. And you can see here, foreigners, there's that, you know, the top line, again, the tops out at $3 trillion, that's foreigners. And then you can see Federal Reserve, and then you can see households, which in the last 2 years alone, household U.S. household holdings of Treasury bonds have risen 40% CAGR, and in the last 12 months, they've risen 70% CAGR. Now, obviously, this isn't really a sustainable dynamic, but this is why the dollar's been rising once foreigners stopped buying treasuries, is somebody had to finance those deficits, and it was Americans financing their own deficits for the first time in 50 to 70 years. Now, unlike central banks who have an infinite balance sheet and are simply politically motivated relative to relative currency valuations, et cetera, my households, private investors in the United States have a finite balance sheet. And so they can buy treasuries or they can buy stocks or they can buy treasuries or they can buy iPhones. But the bottom line is effectively you start having this crowding out effect where private sector demand, U.S. dollar exports start shrinking because we have to start financing our own deficits for the first time in 50 to 70 years. And so what is actually in the long run a very bearish development for the dollar is in the near term, but drives a huge short squeeze that you can see clear as day in 2014 in that real trade weighted dollar. And that's where we come into, you know, the point that we think we're a lot further along this path than a lot of other folks might otherwise think. You can see how this works on slide 13. We talk about this U.S. balance of payment vicious cycle, right? So you start at the top, U.S. deficits rise, that drives an increase in federal borrowing. You know, you go to number two, foreign central banks aren't buying it, so we have to finance it ourselves. Since the amount we're borrowing is rising by a significant percentage of private sector income growth, federal government borrowing crowds out the global private sector. So you get LIBOR up, dollar up, treasury yields up. And so then as that crowding out happens, rates rise, that slows the U.S. economy. So U.S. deficits rise. So as deficits rise, we have to borrow more. And you just keep this spiral going. And basically this spiral is 5 years old. It drives the dollar higher and higher and higher and rates higher and higher and higher, until either the whole system collapses or the Fed basically prints it all.
Luke, at Macro Voices Live in Vancouver, we missed you. It was great seeing you in Toronto. And curiously, even though you weren't able to join us, your name came up in our panel discussion. It was actually the hottest topic of discussion of the entire weekend. And the subject was your view. And basically, the question that was posed is the Luke Grohman view really going to happen? And what was most fascinating to me is when you first started writing about these ideas 5-6 years ago, most people thought you were crazy. But now, unanimously, our entire panel, and it was super smart people, Julian Brigden, Juliet DeClercq, Jeff Snyder, really, really smart people on that panel, they completely agreed that your view, all of them unanimously agreed that your view about the dollar is going to play out in the end game. The thing is, most of the people on the panel think that you're early. They think that everything that you predict will happen someday. And I thought that unto itself was incredibly newsworthy because they didn't think that a few years ago. But they don't think it's time yet. You do seem to think that it is time. So how do we understand the timing dynamics of this whole story?
There's a couple things I'm watching. I mean, clearly, as we led off with, you know, right now we're positioned as positive on the dollar, positive on gold, positive on treasury. So it's not quite time yet, but this is coming far sooner than most people think, in our view. And the reason we think that is, you can see on slide 19 is where we start to lay out the difference in timing. And so the biggest part of that is I had two different, you know, we'll call them graybeards, very, very seasoned veterans. Actually, if I told you who they were, everyone in the audience would know who they are. Veteran macro guys. And they both, in separate conversations, told me, historically, once it becomes apparent that a nation is going to have to print the money to pay the interest on its sovereign debt, markets tend to begin to discount that reality into that nation's currency pretty quickly. And so we wrote that back in September in a, you know, one of our Mr. X pieces. And what we noted in the analysis of that is that we compared it to the movie Moneyball, right? And the concept of the movie Moneyball is that guys that hit a lot of singles get paid a lot more than guys that walk a lot, even though there's no functional difference between a walk and a single in baseball. And what we said was that, as you can see in the quote here, U.S. debt is 100% of GDP is in a Moneyball-esque stats distortion. You know, the $22 trillion in U.S. federal debt is akin to hits in Moneyball, but the $100 to $200 trillion in U.S. entitlements are akin to walks in Moneyball. And so the real U.S. debt number is actually closer to 500 to 1,000% of GDP. But nobody ever counts that because it's always been off balance sheet. And it's always been tomorrow, right? It's always been a cash flow positive. You know, entitlements have, up until a couple of years ago, were cash flow positive. Well, for the first time, you know, starting about 5 years ago, 6 years ago, the U.S. demographics mean that that off-balance sheet stuff is now coming on balance sheet. It's being, as we noted earlier, funded entirely by the U.S. private sector. And it's increasingly being funded at the short end of the curve, right? So if you talk about going from off-balance sheet to on-balance sheet, being funded by a more fickle customer at the front end of the curve, you know, that's a Lehman problem. We've seen this movie before. We just haven't seen it at this scale. And so what we did with those statistics is we said, okay, the true interest, if the problem for a currency comes once the central bank has to print the VIG, print the interest, then we need to define U.S. interest expense properly. And true U.S. interest is not, you know, whatever the number is, you know, 2.5-3% of $22 trillion. The real number is the gross interest expense, that, you know, 3% times $22 trillion, plus the annual PAYGO portion of the entitlements, because the entitlements are just debt. They're off balance sheet, they're coming on, but that's effectively the interest expense for $100 trillion plus in entitlements. And so what we did, we said, okay, let's add gross interest expense plus the entitlements PAYGO portion. And let's look at that relative to U.S. tax receipts, see where we are, and see where that could go. And so what you can see is this, you know, the chart we used on slide 20 in terms of trying to gauge when this is going to become a problem. You can see here that U.S. total interest expense, the true interest expense, hits 100% in 2021 on sort of our base case. In 2021, early 2021, U.S. gross interest expense plus entitlement PAYGOs will be more than 100% of U.S. tax receipts. Importantly, this assumes no slowdown in the world, anywhere in the world. It also includes or assumes, I think, three more rate hikes this year, which is, of course, not looking as likely at this point. But what's interesting in this chart, you can see the ramp from 70% of revenues to 85% of revenues from 2017 to 2018 was driven almost entirely by the Fed, right? And so the, you know, the interest rate differential argument that the Fed's going to keep raising rates and defend the dollar or drive the dollar higher, there's a maximum marginal utility to that. In other words, if they keep raising rates, they're going to bring this date forward because the economy is going to slow, receipts are going to fall, interest expense is going to rise. And so we run the numbers again on slide 21, and this is a minor slowdown case like we just described. And what you can see there is, again, this also assumes some interest rate hikes as well, which, again, have probably been pushed out. But when we ran these numbers in September of last year, what you can see is that true total interest expense goes over 100% in mid-2020. And the markets are likely going to discount that well in advance, 6 to 12 months in advance. And so this is sort of your if there's a slowdown anywhere in the world case. And so when you look at this, our thought process that this is probably well under 24 months from now is based on this math where if the macro guys we've talked to saying, look, whenever a central bank has to print the interest, that's when the currency really starts to get hit as the markets begin to discount that. And when you run these numbers, that's what you come up with. And what's you know, what's really interesting is we had published this for our customers, and literally the day before, as we were typing it out, if you go to slide 16, Ray Dalio laid out the exact thing. He laid out the whole thing, and it was healthcare, unfunded pensions. We got to sell a bunch of treasuries. Americans aren't going to be able to buy them all. The Fed's going to have to print the difference, and the dollar could fall 30%. And it was very eye-opening, because this is not a dragon that Ray Dalio needs to chase. And his point is this probably happens within 2 years. And like we said, it's a moving bogey. If the Fed stops raising rates, it buys time. But that also puts downward pressure on the dollar, all else equal. If the Fed accelerates, that brings it forward. You know, if there's a problem in Europe, if there's a problem in China, if there's a problem in Latin America, that brings us forward. And so that's where we really come to in terms of what's driving our thought process, that this is all likely to play out much sooner than people think.
Let's talk a little bit about what specifically plays out, because to summarize your thesis, you're saying that for a number of reasons, foreigners are abandoning the use of the U.S. dollar. There is no suitable alternative to replace it as the world's global reserve currency, but they're using other currencies to settle as much trade as they're able to, and they're divesting their treasury holdings. And your conclusions from all this are that at some point there's going to be markets really putting downward pressure on the value of the dollar as they start to discount the realization that, we've got a really serious problem with the United States government not being able to finance its own operations. Now, the doomsday crowd would say, okay, so we wake up one morning and martial law has been declared and people have got machine guns in your face. I don't think it's really that. What is it that happens? Is it just a slow, gradual decline where the U.S. dollar starts declining and, you know, in a gradual way for the next 20 years and slowly fades into oblivion as some other currency takes its place? Or is there some kind of an event where, you know, everything goes topsy-turvy and crazy for a while?
Well, I think just to clarify, our case is not that people are stopping using the dollar in trade. I think the statistics show that it continues to be used. Maybe it's lost a little share. It's lost a little share of reserves. But our case is not that it's not being used and it won't be used in the future. Quite frankly, using it doesn't really matter. You can use whatever. The key is settlement. And what is clearly happening in the data is foreign central banks have stopped settling in dollars. They've stopped settling in treasury bonds specifically. And so that's critically important, because that is a statement of everyone's ending up with the same dollars they used to have. But instead of buying treasury bonds, which funds the U.S. government, which is over 100% of U.S. tax receipts are entitlements, defense, and interest expense. So instead of paying for defense, for interest and for entitlements, what China, for example, is doing is taking these dollars and, you know, buying up ports, buying up real assets, making loans in Africa, buying Syngenta GMO seeds. They're buying gold. They're buying copper mines. They're buying iron ore. They're buying basically anything but treasuries. And that is ultimately a problem for the U.S. government, because they still have to find someone to buy this. And what this ends up doing, we end up funding our own deficits. And, you know, it's what Dalio lays out on page 16, is you say, okay, if this was happening, what would be something I would expect to see? I would expect to see LIBOR rising. All right, well, LIBOR bottomed in 3Q14. It's been, you know, up until just recently, pretty much one way up. You'd expect to see bid to covers ratios in the treasury markets falling steadily. They've been falling down and to the right for 5 years. I would expect to see geopolitical tensions rise with the U.S. Sanctioning the parties involved. So we've been sanctioning Russia for 4 years, Iran, Turkey, Venezuela. I would expect to see the United States, a possible strategy would be to get involved in a trade war with China. Because ultimately, you could make a bet that maybe if we get involved in a trade war, we can break the Chinese before we break. And if they break before we break, maybe we end up with more bargaining leverage in this deal. And so the point, of course, is that all of these things have been happening for 5 years, as far back as 5 years, up until, you know, the last 12 to 18 months in the case of China. And so I think we're seeing these things, but they haven't been fully marked to market yet. And ironically, all of these things serve to drive the dollar higher, to suck dry dollar liquidity out of the market. And so Ultimately, though, the higher the dollar goes, the more disruption there is, the more all of these problems get pulled forward. U.S. deficits rise faster instead of slower. We're seeing that. And so really, it's going to, I think, come to the way it plays out is ultimately you have a big risk off and the Fed has to sort of reverse course. And now is the fourth quarter it? That's not what we think. I would have thought that we would have needed more of a risk, a bigger crisis, a bigger problem. But it's certainly possible that that's the case. But I think ultimately the way this plays out is if you go to slide 23, you can see the U.S. Fed's balance. It's a chart here. U.S. Fed balance sheet as a percent of GDP against the Bank of Japan's balance sheet as a percent of GDP, except the BOJ data has lagged 10 years. And so you can see all these things are driving, conspiring to drive the dollar higher. But ultimately, the U.S. government needs to get funded. And the Fed is a fiat currency and a printing press. And so we've seen this movie, right? And I noted there, strong dollar nickels are laying on the ground. And, just to the right of that, U.S. entitlement steamroller that, Dalio and Seth Klarman most recently have been warning about. And so what I think ultimately the way this plays out is, another sign you might expect to see is the U.S. president vilifying the Fed, saying that they're choking off growth, that they're making things difficult for the U.S. government. And of course, we saw Trump beating on the Fed in the second half of last year. And I think ultimately, at some point, you basically get the Fed to reverse course much more drastically in response to a slowdown or in response to a sloppy auction, whatever the case is. And the Fed over some period of, months, years, takes its balance sheet from, you can see there, the first step is from 20% to 30% of GDP over a couple of years. And then, from 30% to 100% over the next 4 or 5 years. My guess is it will happen much faster for the U.S. than for the Bank of Japan whenever it's reversed, because the U.S. has twin deficits and Japan doesn't. But I think that's really what the point is. A lot of the things we'd expect to see, we've checked the box on starting 5 years ago, 4 years ago, 3 years ago, 2 years ago, 6 months ago with Trump beating on the Fed about, the Fed's not helping us, they're hurting us. John Bolton talking about that the U.S. debt is the biggest risk to national security. All these things are signposts that kind of go whizzing by. But I think it all speaks to the same thing, which is this is probably coming and it's likely coming sooner than a lot of people think.
Let's talk about some of the trends that are going on in society, because what you're saying here is U.S. entitlements are basically unaffordable, something we've known for a long time but have been ignoring, and it's all coming to a head, and you think in the next few years it's going to come to a head to the point where we cannot finance the federal deficit anymore because there's not enough foreigners to buy up all that treasury debt. What happens then? Because it seems to me that the social backdrop right now, it's not only that people expect to keep their entitlements, but we're seeing a really strong trend of populism and in the younger generations, an adoption of socialist values where people, many of them, really feel that we need a lot more entitlements, universal basic income, for example. How the heck is that going to work when we can't afford the stuff that we already can't afford?
It's not going to be good for the currency. It's one of these challenging things, right? And this is something I've said in meetings a lot. I've heard from lots of people in very high profile seats off the record in terms of their names. But this is the problem with the way 2008 and 2009 was handled with the bailouts. And by that, I mean, I'm with you. Socialism isn't a good thing. It's not going to work out. The system has failed over and over and over. That said, in 2008, 2009, we overtly had a system where it's socialism for the wealthy and capitalism for the poor, right? The poor lost their houses and the bank CEOs got to keep their stock options, got their full bonuses, and they got their contracts honored, et cetera, et cetera. And at the time, there were some voices saying maybe someone should lose their job, maybe someone should lose their net worth, maybe we should let capitalism work, right? But the problem with the way 2008, 2009 was handled is that the moral authority of basically anybody that has been around Washington and New York for the past 15 to 20 years to say, well, no, socialism doesn't work and we shouldn't do it. And these things you're proposing are bad. They have no moral authority to say these things because they partook in it in 2008 and 2009. Like, the answer should have been bank management's gone, options wiped out, save the banks and then get them smaller and sort of do like a classic restructuring has been done in a number of different places. I think most recently in Sweden around the turn of the century, but it wasn't done that way. And so it hasn't been that big of a surprise to me to see this populism erupting. I mean, one of the more fascinating experiences that I had surrounding the crisis came way after when I went to go see the movie The Big Short based on the Michael Lewis book. I went and saw it in opening weekend here in a very upscale area in Cleveland, Ohio. And that may sound like an oxymoron, but they do exist. And the end of the movie happens and I literally like grabbed my coat, grabbed my wife, pulled my hat down, walked out and got to my car and left because there was literal visceral yelling at the theater screen anger, because it was at that moment, by the end of that movie, even people, you know, just, you know, average Joe Blows, working class guys in Cleveland go, wait a second, this was just a street hustle. That's all this was. This was a fraudulent street hustle. And so when the moral authority to say we can't do these things has been taken away by the way 0809 was handled. And that to me is a, I agree with you. It's an unnerving thing.
What would you say, if I try to play the other side of this, it's one that I don't personally agree with, but my job here is to play devil's advocate. I think that the same people that feel that we need universal basic income would introduce this concept of modern monetary theory, MMT. And they would say, look, Luke, for the last umpteen years, we've had no trouble with inflation. That means that we basically can just print all the money that we need. It's not going to be a problem. What are you worried about? How do you respond to that? And I guess I know that it's pretty easy for you to explain why maybe there's some fallacy in that logic. But what are we going to do as a society when a whole bunch of people who are still pissed off about 0809 decide that's the right answer? Because I think that's coming.
I agree it's coming. And I don't think it's a pure coincidence that all of a sudden MMT is gaining the traction in the mainstream narrative that it is. I think some version of it is coming. Like, I think, you know, I said to someone the other day, my thoughts on MMT are, we'll say, they're complicated, right? Now, which is not to say they're elaborate or anything. I just, I'm of two minds of it in a couple of different ways. But ultimately, my opinion on MMT doesn't matter. If we didn't want to do MMT, we either need 75 million baby boomers to, you know, sort of vanish by the end of next week, or we need to get in an 83 DeLorean with a flux capacitor and go back to 1937 and stop FDR from passing Social Security and then, you know, make a stop in 1968 and get LBJ to not pass Medicare and Medicaid. But you look at this, people have been saying, well, ever since Trump got elected, there'll be stimulus. The U.S. will do stimulus. And, you know, what something I wrote shortly after Trump got elected and this sort of the stimulus talk happened was, look, the U.S. has already promised $100 to $200 trillion in stimulus. It was promised by Franklin Delano Roosevelt. It was promised by LBJ. And it was promised by George W. Bush with Medicare Part D. And that's a smaller part of it. But the bottom line is there are 75 million people who overspent and undersaved for 80 years because they were told the government would take care of them in the end. And the bills do, right? This is not that different from AIG picking up nickels in front of a steamroller and writing mortgage insurance. And it was a great business right up to the point it wasn't. And this is sort of the same thing, is that, you know, the U.S. government was collecting these premiums and spending them elsewhere. And now the bills do. And, you know, the bottom line is if we didn't want to get to MMT or something like it, that was a decision that should have been made 80 years ago, 50 years ago, 20 years ago with Medicare Part D. But, you know, it's human nature. Look, politicians like to spend and people like free stuff, and particularly free stuff that's not going to show up until someday. You know, it sort of stinks for the people who are there when someday arrives, but it sort of is what it is.
What happens? I'm going to make a bold prediction here, which I think you'll probably agree with, which is even though it's probably not the right thing, what I think is going to happen over the next few years is that this populist, socialist, whatever you want to call it, it's going to get bigger. and there are going to be more demands for helicopter money of some form, you know, QE for the people, call it what you will. If there is another major economic dislocation and anybody is proposing anything remotely similar to QE, back in 08, 09, the left didn't know what all of this stuff meant. They've done their homework now. They know exactly what's going on. And I think they're ready to say, look, no more bailouts for Wall Street. We're going to conjure money out of thin air. Let's give it to the people who need it. That, I have to believe, is inflationary. Let's suppose that whether or not you and I think that's a good policy choice, that what happens is we're instituting universal basic income and we're giving out helicopter money in order to stimulate in response to the next economic recession or downturn, which feels like maybe it's already starting. Well, how does it play out? What are the consequences and what happens as a result if you make those kinds of policy errors?
To me, it's instructive. I think we have a slide in here. If you go to slide 18, and this is sovereign debt as a percent of GDP going back to 1900 from Carmen Reinhart and Ken Rogoff. And the orange line is advanced economy debt, and the green line is emerging market or developing market sovereign debt as percent of GDP. And what you can see in this is we're at the highest level for advanced economies since right after World War II, except we haven't fought a war this time. And so there's not, you know, sort of a rebuilding period that needs to happen. And there's not been a sort of a tragic loss of life that has worked down the workforce.
Well, there's another aspect of that, too, which is right after World War II, GDP was depressed. So you change the denominator and you artificially accelerate that graph. If you used steady state GDP from before the war, it wouldn't look that bad. But as you say, it's real this time.
Well, yes and no. I mean, the GDP war is really, really good for it's very inflationary, at least. Right. So it's good for at least nominal GDP. But yeah, the consumption side of the economy was definitely depressed and rationed. But I think it's, if we just use this as a potential reference point for sort of where do we go from here? How's this going to play out over the next, you know, call it 5 years? From 1942 to 1951, U.S. Treasury bonds did not fall in price at all. The Fed said that they would buy every 10-year Treasury the U.S. issued at 2.5%, no questions asked. And those 10-year Treasury bonds fell 80% against the S&P. In other words, the S&P outperformed by 5x nominally. Those Treasuries underperformed CPI by about 75%. The bottom line is holders of Treasury bonds got killed on a real basis. And that's going to happen again, which is really interesting, right? Because guess who the biggest marginal buyers of Treasuries have been over the last 3 years since foreign central banks, or 5 years since foreign central banks stopped buying them? It's U.S. households, it's U.S. commercial banks, and it's U.S. pensions, who, you know, most listeners will recognize as sort of the usual suspects. They were the biggest players in housing. They were the biggest players in the tech bubble. You know, they're sort of, unfortunately, the people kind of get hit, the groups that get sort of plugged with this stuff. And so last time at the end of World War II, to work down that bubble, as you can see, the orange chart, you know, as we delevered, that required negative 15 to negative 60% real rates for anywhere from 4 to 9 years, right? So if you hold a sovereign bond and the real rate falls, you know, at negative 15% rates, like, your money's gone on a real basis in 3 years, 4 years. 60, it's gone in a year and a half. And that's what's going to happen again. It's it's either that or they nominally default on entitlements, and they slash defense spending by probably 2/3 to 3/4. I don't think either of those two things are politically likely. And so ultimately, you know, usually the way these things work out are high rates of inflation. And you can see from, you know, Rogoff and Reinhardt's piece here, right? It's default, restructuring, and a few hyperinflations. Default, restructuring, and a few hyperinflations every time these numbers get here. And it's, they say it's never different this time. I doubt it's different this time this way. I think the key is, how do they do that, and what are sort of some of the social ramifications of doing that, as you know, which I think is a great point.
Let's talk about how gold plays into this story, because when you and I first started talking about this in our first interview more than a year ago, you described this long-term vision of the dollar weakening dramatically as it falls from favor as everybody's favorite reserve currency. I agreed with that, but I also felt like, look, the dollar is going to be rising relative to other currencies in the short term. I think you'll be right in the long term. But as long as the dollar's rising, that can't be good for gold. And I was right about that for a while. It wasn't good for gold. Now we've got the dollar rising and gold rising at the same time. What do you think changed to bring that about? And do you think it's set to continue?
I think we're at a critical moment to see if it's set to continue. If we see gold break out from, I don't know, call it 1400, 1380, 1400, then I think, you know, we've really got something. Until then, I'm on record a number of times saying, like, I don't think gold's been a real market since at least 2013. It's basically been pegged to the dollar at around, you know, 1150 to 1350 for 6 years. So I'm watching with interest. Now, that said, is this it? You know, is this the breakout? To me, it makes perfect sense that as the crisis, you know, the next crisis is going to be the popping of the global sovereign debt bubble that we're in, which is only happens once every 80 to 100 years. And usually it doesn't happen until everyone that lived through the last one's dead. And as we get nearer the next crisis, gold should rise with the dollar, with rates. And that, I think, will puzzle a lot of people, because ultimately, as we get nearer to it, you know, the more the dollar rises and the more rates rise is going to bring forward the date when the Fed's got to print it all, right? You know, we go back to those slides I showed where if rates rise or the dollar rises from where we are, then sort of, you know, 2021 becomes 2020, becomes late 2019 to when, you know, if they rise enough, to when the Fed is going to have to print the interest expense. By the interest expense, it's the true interest expense, right? It's printing entitlements and it's printing interest expense. And so I am skeptical, I've been beaten over the head enough watching gold hit 1350 and then go back to 1150 and then back to 1350, for 6 years that I'm holding judgment. But I'm also really aware, or acutely aware, that this is exactly what we'd see as we near sort of the global sovereign debt bubble starting to burst, which is, you know, and it's interesting, right? Because global central banks just bought the most gold in 50 years. In the last 6 years, global central banks have sold on net $130 billion in treasuries, and they've bought $140 billion in gold. And so these are people that, for them, it doesn't really matter if they're right away. It just matters that they're positioned for whenever it happens. They don't have to market to market, et cetera. They're telling you that, to me, continues to be one of the biggest signs, and one of the biggest underappreciated signs, is that nobody really has a great answer for, which is why in the last 5 years have central banks sold $130 billion in treasuries and bought $140 billion in gold? And I think the answer is they sort of see everything that, you know, we're talking about here, Eric, which is this crisis is coming. It will come sooner if the dollar rises. It will come sooner if interest rates rise. But to me, it's really a positive, very positive setup for gold, because if the way you stave off this crisis from coming is you weaken the dollar. Well, if you weaken the dollar, that's good for gold. Well, and if this crisis comes, ultimately, that's really good for gold, too. So it's one of these times where, you know, I don't think institutions are heavily positioned in gold away from sort of, you know, trading accounts, at a time when it seems like gold is one of the few assets that, A, is one of the cheapest on the board. It's still cheap relative to historically speaking, and it looks like it wins either way.
Luke, let's talk about what kind of crisis is coming and what the scope of it really is going to be, because I think you just said something very important a few minutes ago when you said that it's only once every 80 to 100 years when most of the people who remember the last one are dead that you resolve a sovereign debt over-indebtedness crisis. I would say it's not just sovereign debt. It's also corporate and private debt is also at ridiculous levels. Does that mean that Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez comes riding in with a flag and announces that what we need is a global debt jubilee? What happens? What's the range of possibility as to how we might resolve this confluence of crises? Because it's bigger than just the dollar and treasury bonds. We're really talking, as you said, about a global debt crisis. How do you think this gets resolved?
Yeah, it is. And the dollar and treasury bonds have been the center of the global financial system for 50 to 70 years. And so it's interesting, right? Because one of the biggest strawman arguments people say to me is, well, there's no replacement for the dollar. There's nothing to take the dollar's place. And that's not a, it's not a case I'm making. It's never a case I've made, which is that something else is going to replace the dollar. The problem, like we noted before, is that if other central banks won't sterilize our deficits, if they won't hold our treasuries, then we have to fund it ourselves. And we're going to basically collapse the economy buying, you know, basically funding our own deficits, paying for our own entitlements. And so what that suggests the crisis is going to be is you're going to have, you know, sort of this, there'll be a slowdown somewhere, there'll be a crisis somewhere, just sort of it looks like, is it a Deutsche Bank problem? Is it a China problem? Is it, you know, hey, is it a U.S. recession? The crazy thing is it doesn't really matter. People say, well, Europe's going to go first. Okay, let's take Europe first. Let's pretend Deutsche Bank blows up. Boom. You're going to get a sell-off in Europe. European authorities will say, you know what? We're going to shut markets down for a week and sort this all out. Guess what happens then? Then the asset that we have here in the U.S., right, we have the deepest, most liquid markets in the world, becomes a liability. Because guess what? All the selling in the world is going to come. Europe's closed, and I got to lay off that risk. I'm coming to the U.S., and I am selling everything I can get my hands on. U.S. authorities go, we're done here. Markets are closed. You know, we do something like we did in September of 08, where they said, short selling ban on financials, can't short sell financials. Except they'll say, you know what? We're closing it all. We're going to shut it down for 5 days, and we're going to sort it all out. And then, you know, of course, they would do that in China as well. And you'd wake up in 5 days and you'd probably have some sort of reset of currency levels. You'd probably have a reset higher in gold. And you basically just continue on from that point. I think it would likely be fairly brief. And I think it would be probably fairly dramatic. And I think one thing that I think people are really underestimating is the likelihood that it will be discontinuous or nonlinear. In other words, there is this expectation that I'm going to own dollars, and I'm going to own dollars all the way up, and then at the right moment, I'm going to go from the one side of the boat to the other side of the boat, and it'll all be great, and then I'll take my really expensive dollars, and I'll buy really cheap assets, and it'll all work out great. And the history of it all suggests you can do that for a while, but it's a sort of, you know, pigs get fat, hogs get slaughtered sort of a thing, right? Because the history books are very clear that these things happen nonlinear. They'll shut the markets down. And Jim Rickards had talked about this in his one of his recent books, Road to Ruin. One of the most fascinating passages in the book is he quotes a senior level BlackRock exec at the beginning of the book. And she tells him in third quarter of 2014 that the U.S. government had already approached BlackRock about selling bans. In other words, in the next crisis, BlackRock would not be allowed to sell. And if BlackRock couldn't, nobody could. And, you know, I actually floated that around to some other places where and said, hey, is that crazy? And the people I talked to said, no, it's not crazy. That's a much greater likelihood of happening. And so to me, what would that crisis look like? It would almost look like a whoosh down and then a dislocation of markets and then a reset higher. So, hey, you know, S&P 2700, whoosh, S&P 1900, market shut for 5 days, S&P, you know, 4,000, $1.95, $1.10, market shut down, $1.50, that kind of thing, where I just don't think it's going to be linear all the way through, given, you know, to your point, it's not just a sovereign problem. It's a corporate problem. It's a personal debt problem. The whole system is so levered. The wiggle room is so it's going to be really hard to sort of fix things on the fly. And so it speaks to my point that a nonlinearity or a discontinuity in markets, you know, that they'll shut markets for a period of time is, I wouldn't go all the way to base case, but I don't think it's a tail risk. I think it's somewhere between a base case and a tail risk.
Well, if the proverb holds true, one thing is certain, which is that these will be interesting times in the next few years. For the benefit of our listeners who need to navigate financially through these interesting times, tell us a little bit about what you do at Forest for the Trees.
Sure. Thanks, Eric. Yeah, we are a investment research firm, and for institutions and sophisticated individuals, we have a number of different research products, and you can check out more about what we're up to and different product options on FFTT, FrankTomTom-LLC.com.
Fantastic. Thanks so much for joining us, Luke. We look forward to having you back again soon. Patrick Ceresna and I will be back as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com.
Macro Voices is a listener-driven program. Please email requests for specific future interview guests to requests@macrovoices.com. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer them on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. We also welcome your suggestions for how we can improve the program. Now, back to your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna.
Eric, that was a great interview we just had with Luke, but we brought into our post-game Brent Johnson from San Diego Capital. How you doing, Brent?
I'm good. Thanks for giving me a call. I appreciate it.
Brent, for the benefit of our listeners who were not able to attend Macro Voices Live, I just want to bring them up to date. We had a fantastic panel discussion, and I asked the panel what were the most important topics in macro and in finance. And the topic that you introduced was, is Luke Grohmann crazy? And you were very professional and respectful in essentially saying that you agree with a lot of Luke's long-term conclusions. And what was most fascinating to me was, when a lot of people seem to think Luke is crazy, at least with respect to his timing, I asked the entire panel, is Luke going to be proven right in the end? And I thought it was the most fascinating and interesting part of that whole live event, when we had unanimous agreement on the panel that Luke's views about the U.S. dollar are going to be proven right in the end. I think everyone, including you, agreed on that. But many people, and you were certainly the leader of the opposition, disagreed on the timing. So first of all, am I characterizing that right? Do you agree with Luke's long-term conclusions and just disagree on the timing? Or do you disagree with Luke in terms of his fundamental argument as to what's going to happen and why?
So yeah, that was it was a great time up there in Vancouver, and thank you guys again for having me up there. It would have been great to have Luke there in person to be able to, you know, discuss this live. But for the most part, Luke and I agree where this all ends up. I can't say that I agree with everything that he agrees with long term, but much of what he points out for the long term, I do agree with. Where we mainly disagree is the timing of it happening and what the knock-on effects of some of the let's call them red flags that he's identified and some of the issues that he's identified. I see the knock-on effects of those being a little different. So whereas I might agree with him that certain things are happening now, we disagree on when it ultimately plays out, and we may disagree on some of the knock-on effects of those red flags or those road markers, however you want to describe them.
So now, Brent, which particular red flag sticks out the most for you? What's the one that you want to focus on here?
Well, one of the things I would say is that Luke has identified the fact that the rising cost of the debt and the interest on the debt will push us into severe budget deficits and will ultimately eclipse, you know, 100% of tax revenue, et cetera, et cetera. He's absolutely right. He has identified that very well and done a very good job of alerting people to that happening. I would just point out that that argument has been around for a number of years now. It's not really a new argument. I think he has probably done a better job of explaining it and bringing it to the forefront in the last year or so than many people, but had you gone to a precious metals conference in 2010, 11, or 12, you would have heard much of the same arguments that we would eventually hit here. And, you know, as we move forward in time, we get closer and closer to that. So I think I give him a lot of credit for identifying that and explaining the problems that that rise in cost of interest poses. He sent out to you guys a great deck of like 28 slides making his case, which he makes a very good case, and I think everybody should look at his slides and consider carefully what he's saying. I think he's missing some slides, and I think the slides he's missing are the 28 pages on the euro and the 28 pages on the yen and the 28 pages on the yuan and the 28 pages on the Australian dollar, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Because if you do similar types of calculations and you do similar types of analysis on other currencies, you realize that they are in very high levels of trouble as well. And when you speak about fiat currency eventually, you know, losing value or dying, I understand why people do it, but there's not a lot of value in just saying it because everybody knows that has any sense of history that fiat currencies die. The value comes in figuring out when that happens. And that's kind of where Luke and I disagree. He thinks that it comes sooner than I do. I think it happens later than he does. And the main reason I think it happens is because if the U.S. was in the situation that we are in, and all those other currencies that I mentioned before were even in a halfway decent shape, then perhaps I would be more on board with what he is saying. I'm sympathetic to his view. I totally understand the point he's trying to make. I just think when you realize that fiat currencies are all measured against one another, and you realize the institutional effect that the dollar has and the momentum that the dollar has and the number of, you know, institutions and people and systems around the world that depend on dollar funding, to me, it is obvious that the dollar has to get stronger before it gets weaker. And so I think where Luke and I primarily disagree is, again, the timing, which we've already said, but then also the knock-on effects of some of these road marks that he said. And I think the big one is our ability to fund our deficits easier than other countries able to fund their budgets.
Okay, hang on a second, Brent, because I want to make sure I'm not reading too much into what you're saying here. It sounds to me like Luke is making a lot of really dire predictions, saying the United States government is headed for a really serious fiscal crisis where we'll get to the point where there's no choice but for the Fed to monetize the interest payments because we've exceeded 100% of tax revenues, and that's going to cause the U.S. dollar to take a nosedive compared to other currencies. And it sounds to me like your rebuttal to that is, no, it's not going to go down that way because it's not just the U.S. that's going to get into dire fiscal consequences when the government is unable to fund its own operations. That's going to happen to the entire developed world. And since it's happening to the entire developed world and these currencies are relative to one another, the dollar is not going to take a dive right away. Now, please tell me if I'm reading too much into it, but that sounds like a more dire prediction than Luke's version.
Well, you know, you have it correct, and it is a very dire prediction. And, you know, I've tried to, in many of my different interviews and when I've spoken about this subject, to explain that this is not a story that ends well. This is not a happy story. When I say that the dollar is going to get stronger and that the U.S. is going to weather the storm in the short term better than other places around the world, this doesn't mean that it's all sunny and roses and, you know, like going to Disneyland here. I think the global economy is turning down. I just think that the knock-on effects of that are different than what most people think it is. And so, you know, I would agree with the way you've characterized it. A lot of times the rebuttal to my argument here is they will say, yes, but, you know, those other countries don't have the same levels of budget deficits that we do. They have trade surpluses, et cetera, et cetera. My comeback to that is, yes, but if the U.S. goes into this severe recession or turns down in the manner of which you're speaking so that the government can't even fund itself and the dollar loses an incredible amount of values, those countries are no longer running the budget deficits or those budget surpluses and the trade surpluses because their biggest customer, or at least one of their biggest customers, is now in dire straits. And you know, I don't know any business that can lose its first, second, or third biggest customer and just keep on humming as if they have no problems. So if the U.S. does go into this fiscal crisis prior to everybody else and our economy turns down and we're not able to get any tax revenues and nobody else will fund us, that does not bode well for the rest of the world either. And I think, in my opinion, it's going to hit them before it hits us.
Brent, I want to come back to one of the key questions that I asked Luke in this interview, which is he described, you know, it only happens once every 80 or 100 years, but you get to the point where there's debt saturation and everything kind of needs to be reset. And we didn't get into a whole lot of detail about how that would occur. How do you see this ultimately resolving? Let's assume that we flip a coin. Maybe Luke is right and the U.S. runs into this horrible crisis before the rest of the world. Maybe you're right and the rest of the world has it first before the U.S. But one way or another, it sounds like everybody agrees that the whole developed world is so just overburdened with debt that something's got to give and we're going to be in big trouble and there's got to be some kind of reset. What's that reset? What does it look like? Do we have a socialist uprising and a debt jubilee or what happens?
Yeah, it's a very good question. Long story short, yes, I do think that there is going to be some type of reset, for lack of a better word. Now, whether that is a managed reset by the central banks who do it in coordination and everybody agrees and, you know, it's kind of a nice, peaceful reset, I say peaceful in air quotes, or whether it's a market forced reset where, you know, it's just chaos from one country to another and the market takes care of all the bad debts, I'm not sure. My guess is that we will get into a case of the bad debts forcing the central bank's hands. I don't think it'll be another 5 years before this happens, but I also don't think it happens in the next 1 year. So I think, you know, I'm being a little bit obtuse here, I guess, but I would say we've got 2 to 3 more years, potentially 4 more years, but I don't think we have 5. Ultimately, I do think that the central banks will in some form or another forgive the debts that they hold on their balance sheets. Now, I don't have exactly how they will do that, but I have a hard time believing that that won't happen in some form or another. The debts are just too big everywhere, not just the U.S. China's issued more credit in the last 25 years than we have in our 250 years of history. So this is not a uniquely American phenomenon. The debt always gets paid either by the lender or the borrower, right? And history shows that governments typically don't take it on the chin. They typically pass that burden on to the citizens. And so whether that's through some kind of a debt jubilee that allows them to keep borrowing and spending and, you know, it manifests itself in inflation for the citizens, or at least a loss of purchasing power for the citizens, history tells us that's typically how it works. Whether it'll be that way this time or not, I don't know, but I would anticipate that down the road we're going to see high levels of inflation to take care of these debts.
Now, Brent, I want to circle back to when Luke was talking about this idea of the interest expense plus the entitlement paygo, that when we hit this 100% mark where the governments basically can't, through their tax receipts, cover this. And first of all, I wanted to just simply ask the question, do you agree with Luke that once we pass this 100% threshold, that that becomes like a trigger? Because, you know, what I was thinking when I was listening to it as well, what if we hit 100%? On that and nothing happens? Do you agree with him in principle that this is like a turn point in the markets, that this is truly what the timing element in this moment and as we go in the next few years?
Well, I think this is where we get back to. I agree with him a little bit, but I can't say that I agree with him 100% here. I think largely he has the timing right. I think if I remember exactly what he said in his interview, is he said by his calculations, the interest on the debt exceeds tax revenue in a couple years down the road, and he thought that the market would start discounting ahead of those couple years, right? So, I think it's an important marker to take notice of. I'm not belittling the marker that he's laid out, but I don't think there's anything set in stone that says, you know, once you get to 100% of interest expense or tax revenue, interest expense exceeds it, that you automatically have a fiscal crisis. I still think that we're going to be able to borrow both internally and I think externally we'll get some borrowing. I know, you know, Luke continues to talk about how since, you know, I think it's fourth quarter of 2014, they've stopped buying our debt, which is true. You just look at the chart, it's right there. But that doesn't mean that you won't see some of that come back as their currencies start to come under pressure and people seek out a safe haven. I think many people would rather own a U.S. Treasury than an Italian Treasury or a French Treasury or an Australian Treasury or a Canadian Treasury. So I think our debt will become more attractive despite the horrible fiscal situation that we're in. So I don't think that there's necessarily a hard stop at the 100% of tax revenue that Luke says, but I tend to agree that, you know, 2 to 3 years from now is kind of the area where we're, you know, the rubber's going to hit the road, so to speak. So, you know, I can't completely disagree with him, but I don't think that that's a hard stop number.
Brent, I agree with you. I think that since the U.S. plays such a pivotal role in the global financial system, even when you get to that point where, and I think Luke is absolutely right, that we're going to get to the point where 100% of tax revenue is consumed just servicing the debt and I'll call it the phantom debt that exists in unfunded liabilities and entitlements. But I think that you could still move past that point just because the idea that the U.S. Treasury bond is no longer a safety asset, there's just no good replacement for it. But at the end of the day, we're talking about something that we all agree, I think, cannot last forever. It's a question of whether hitting that 100% suddenly pulls a trigger and everything blows up, or if that's lighting the fuse that takes a few years before everything blows up. Is there a scenario here where everything doesn't blow up eventually?
Wow. You know, I don't think so. I don't. Well, you can never say never. There's many people have hung themselves on the words never or, you know, impossible or it can never happen. So I can't say never, say never. But I can envision a scenario where everybody is still chugging along 5 to 10 years from now. I don't think that will happen, but I can't say it's impossible. I mean, look what Japan's done for the last 20 to 25 years. I mean, I don't think back in 1989, if people knew where they would be 10 years later, that you could say 10 years after that, rates would still be at zero, but they are. So it's not impossible for me to envision, but I just have a, again, I think it's because everybody's in this situation. If the U.S. and maybe one or two other countries were in this situation, then potentially. But because there's literally every place is in the same situation, or almost every place is in the same situation, I just don't think we get into a situation where, you know, we just keep trudging along for another 10 to 20 years. Can never say never, but I think this is all going to play out in the next five.
I want to make a prediction and ask you to react to it. My prediction is this. I don't know how this is all going to play out, but I think that the punctuating, guiding principle, and believe me, I don't like it. I'm predicting not what I want to happen, but what I think will happen. I think that we're in a major social trend change where free market capitalism is on the way out and a more socialist mentality is on the way in. And I personally don't like it, but the trend is clear, it's visible, and it's obvious. So my thinking is that if something really bad is going to happen to the financial system in the next 5 years, which you and Luke seem to agree on, I think the most likely resolution to it will probably be that the folks that are pushing modern monetary theory, or MMT, and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, the new Democratic Socialist Party, I don't know if she's the leader or whatever, but she seems to be very popular. I think that those are the folks that are going to be in charge of making the decisions, and I'm not at all comfortable with that. I think it could lead to some really disastrous outcomes, but I think that those are the people that are going to have the most political power in the next 5 years. Do you agree with me, and what do you think could happen?
So in general, yes, I agree with you. I don't know necessarily that the Democrats are going to win the next election. I still think that Trump will win the next election if he decides to run. But I kind of believe that regardless of which party gets in, they're all going to, to a certain extent, embrace these MMT policies and these further fiscally irresponsible problems. And then they'll try to blame it on the previous administration or the previous 10 years and say, we're in a crisis now. We have to do this. We don't want to, but we have to. And I don't see a big difference between the Democrats and the Republicans other than, you know, the kind of color of hats that they wear. And so I think all governments always double down. They always blame the previous administration. They all say we're in a crisis and we have to do this. I don't see a new administration, whether Republican or Democrat, coming in and backing down on the previous 10 or 15 years policies or 50 years policies. I see them all doubling down on the previous policies. And so I think whether we like it or not, these socialist type movements are coming. And I don't think the market cares whether we like it or not. I think the market's kind of demanding those things. And this kind of relates back to my theory as well, and I kind of want to point this out because I think a lot of people get this wrong, is that I don't really advocate what I think is going to happen with the dollar. I don't really like that it's going to happen. I don't think it's just. I don't think it's moral. I just think it's what's going to happen, right? It's not my job to pontificate on what should or should not happen. It's my job to kind of sit back and look at the facts and figure out what is going to happen, whether I like it or not. So I think that these socialist movements, these around the world, these populist movements around the world, the strong dollar, I think all of this stuff is coming, whether I like it or not. So what I try to do is just point this out to people and have them be prepared for it. They can ultimately decide for themselves what to believe and how to react. It's just my job to kind of analyze the situation and put it out there and hopefully help some people along the way.
Well, Brent, I can't thank you enough for being on the show, and we look forward to having you back.
Thanks again for having me, guys.
Thanks for coming, Brent. And folks, we need your help promoting Macro Voices. So please tell your friends and colleagues about Macro Voices, forward your research roundup emails, and most importantly, register your free account at macrovoices.com. Doesn't cost you anything. We won't spam you, and you will get our research roundup email, which never contains any advertising or marketing. It's just a compendium of links to all of the best content we could find on the internet each week, including supporting materials for our feature interviews. Patrick, tell them what's in this week's research roundup.
In this week's research roundup, you're going to find the transcript for today's show, as well as a link to the chart book for Luke Roman's presentation. There's also a link to the Variant Perception blog article discussing things turning around for the U.S. energy market, and as well as an article from Ray Dalio spelling out America's worst nightmare. So you'll find this and so much more in this week's research roundup. So that does it for this week's episode. We appreciate all the feedback and support we get from our listeners, and we're always looking for suggestions on how we can make the program even better. Now, for those of our listeners that write or blog about the markets and would like to share that content with our listeners, send us an email at researchroundup@macrovoices.com or tag it with the MVRR hashtag on Twitter, and we'll include it in our weekly distributions. If you have not already, follow our main Twitter account at Macro Voices for all the most recent updates and releases. You can also follow Eric on Twitter at Eric S. Townsend and myself at Patrick Ceresna. On behalf of Eric Townsend and myself, thank you for listening, and we'll see you all next week.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com, the Internet's premier source of online education for traders. Please visit BigPictureTrading.com for more information. Please register your free account at MacroVoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly Research Roundup email containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the internet each week. You'll also gain access to our free listener discussion forums and research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we'll be able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week free of charge. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer your questions on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com and by funding from Fourth Turning Capital Management, LLC. For more information, visit MacroVoices.com.